Only the women are ever seen outside their villages, Noel was saying. But the gnarled, white-haired old man cut off when Matt entered the wagon, pulling the door shut behind him. The scraps of lace at Noel's wrists had seen better days, as had his well-cut coat of fine gray wool, but both were clean and neat, though in truth they looked odd with his crooked fingers and battered face. Those belonged on an aging tavern tough, one who had gone on fighting long past his prime. Ulver, in the good blue coat Matt had made for him, grinned as widely as an ogier. Light he was a good boy, but he would never be handsome with those big ears and that wide mouth. His manner with women needed vast improvement if he was ever to have any luck there at all. Matt had been trying to spend more time with Ulver, to get him away from the influence of his uncles, Vannin and Harnan, and the other Red Arms, and the boy seemed to enjoy that. Just not as much as he enjoyed playing snakes and foxes or stones with Tuon and staring at Seleucia's bosom. It was all very well for those fellows to teach Ulver how to shoot a bow and use a sword and the like, but if Matt ever learned who was teaching him to leer...
"Manners, toy,"
Tuon drawled, like honey sliding out of a dish. Hard honey. Around him, unless they were playing stones, her expression was usually severe enough for a judge handing down a death sentence, and her tone matched it.
"You knock, then wait for permission to enter. Unless you are property or a servant, then you do not knock. You also have grease on your coat. I expect you to keep yourself clean."
Ulver's grin faded at hearing Matt admonished. Noel raked bent fingers through his long hair and sighed, then began studying the green plate in front of him as if he might find an emerald among the olives. Grim tone or no grim tone, Matt enjoyed looking at the dark little woman who was to be his wife, who was halfway his wife already. Light, all she had to do was say three sentences and the thing was done. Burn him, but she was beautiful. Once he had mistaken her for a child, but that had been because of her size, and her face had been obscured by a transparent veil. Without that veil, it was plain that that heart-shaped face belonged to a woman. Her big eyes were dark pools a man could spend a lifetime swimming in. Her rare smiles could be mysterious or mischievous, and he prized them. He enjoyed making her laugh, too, at least when she was not laughing at him. True, she was a little slimmer than he had always preferred, but if he could ever get an arm around her without Seleucia there, he believed she would feel just right. And he might convince her to give him a few kisses with those full lips. Light, he dreamed about that sometimes. Never mind that she called him down as if they were really married. Well, almost never mind. Burn him if he could see what a little grease mattered. Lopin and Nerim, the two serving men he was saddled with, would fight over which one got to clean the coat. They had little enough to do that they really would if he did not name who received the task. He did not say that to her. Women like nothing better than making you defend yourself, and once you started, she had won. "I'll try to remember that, precious," he said with his best smile, sliding in beside Seleucia and putting his hat down on the other side from her. The blanket scrunched up between them, and they were a foot apart to boot, yet you would have thought he had pressed himself against her hip. Her eyes were blue, but the furious look she gave him was hot enough his coat should have been singed. "I hope there's more water than wine in that cup in front of Ulver."
"It's goat's milk," the boy said indignantly.
"Ah, well, maybe Ulver was still a little too young even for well-watered wine." Tuon sat up very straight, though she was still shorter than Seleucia, who was a short woman herself.
"What did you call me?" she said, as close to crisply as her accent allowed.
"Precious. You have a pet name for me, so I thought I should have one for you, Precious." He thought Seleucia's eyes were going to pop right out of her head.
"I see," Tuon murmured, pursing her lips in thought.
The fingers of her right hand waggled as though idly, and Seleucia immediately slid off the bed and went to one of the cupboards. She still took time to glare at him over Tuon's head.
"Very well," Tuon said after a moment. "It will be interesting to see who wins this game, toy."
Matt's smile slipped. Game? He was just trying to regain a little balance. But she saw a game, and that meant he could lose. Was likely to, since he had no idea what the game was. Why did women always make things so complicated? Seleucia resumed her place and slid a chipped cup in front of him, and a blue-glazed plate that held half a loaf of crusty bread, 6 varieties of pickled olives mounded up, and 3 sorts of cheese. That perked his spirits again. He had hoped for this, if not expected it. Once you got a woman feeding you, she had a hard time finding it in herself to stop you from putting your feet under her table again.
"The thing of it is," Noel said, resuming his tale, "in those Ayad villages you can see women of any age, but no men much above 20, if that. Not a one."
Oliver's eyes grew even wider. The boy practically inhaled Noel's tales about the countries he had seen, even the lands beyond the Aiel Waste, swallowed them whole without butter.
"Are you any relation to Jane Charn, Noel?"
Matt chewed an olive and discreetly spat the pit into his palm. The thing tasted not far from spoiling. So did the next one. But he was hungry, so he gobbled them down and followed with some crumbly white goat cheese while ignoring the frowns Tuan directed at him. The old man's face went still as stone, and Matt had torn off a piece of bread and eaten that as well before Noel answered.
"A cousin,"
he said at last, grudgingly.
"He was my cousin."
"You're related to Jane Farstrider?" Ulver said excitedly. His favorite book was The Travels of Jane Farstrider, which he would have sat up reading by lamplight long past his bedtime had Julin and Thera allowed. He said he intended to see everything Farstrider had when he grew up, all that and more.
"Who is this man with 2 names?" Tuan asked. "Only great men are spoken of so, and you speak as if everyone should know him." "He was a fool," Noel said grimly before Matt could open his mouth,
though Ulver did get his open and left it gaping while the old man continued.
"He went gallivanting about the world and left a good and loving wife to die of a fever without him there to hold her hand while she died. He let himself be made into a tool by—"
Abruptly, Noel's face went blank. Staring through Matt, he rubbed at his forehead as though attempting to recall something.
"Jane Farstrider was a great man," Ulver said fiercely. His hands curled into small fists, as though he was ready to fight for his hero. "He fought Trollocs and Murdral, and he had more adventures than anyone else in the whole world, even Matt. He captured Cawen Girmallan, after Girmallan betrayed Malkir to the Shadow."
Noel came to himself with a start and patted Ulver's shoulder.
"He did that, boy. That much is to his credit. But what adventure is worth leaving your wife to die alone?"
He sounded sad enough to die on the spot himself. Ulver had no answer to that, and his face fell. If Noel had put the boy off his favorite book, Matt was going to have words with the old man. Reading was important. He read himself. Sometimes he did. And he made sure Ulver had books he enjoyed. Standing, Tuan leaned across the table to rest a hand on Noel's arm. The stern look had vanished from her face, replaced by tenderness. A wide belt of dark yellow tooled leather cinched her waist, emphasizing her slim curves. More of his coin spent? Well, coin was always easy to come by for him, and if she did not spend it, likely he would throw it away on some other woman.
"You have a good heart, Master Charon."
She gave everybody their bloody names except for Matt Cawthon.
"Do I, my lady?"
Noel said, sounding as though he really wanted to hear an answer.
"Sometimes I think—"
Whatever he thought sometimes, they were not to learn it now. The door swung open, and Julin put his head into the wagon. The Tyran thief-catcher's conical red hat was at its usual jaunty angle, but his dark face was worried.
"Shanchan's soldiers are setting up across the road. I'm going to Thera. She'll take a fright if she hears it from anybody else."
And as quickly as that, he was gone again, leaving the door swinging. Chapter 7. A Cold Medallion. Shanchan soldiers. Blood and bloody ashes. That was all Matt needed, with the dice spinning his head.
"Noel, find Aginan and Warner. Ulver, you won the Aes Sedai. And Bethamen and Seda."
Those 5 would all be together, or at least close by one another. The 2 former Suldam shadowed the sisters whenever they left the wagon they all shared. Lighty hoped none of them had gone into the town again.
That could put a weasel in the chicken yard for sure.
I'll go down to the entrance and try to see if we're in any trouble.
She won't answer to that name,
Noel muttered, sliding out from the table. He moved spryly for a fellow who looked to have half the bones in his body broken one time or another.
You know she won't.
You know who I mean,
Matt told him sharply, frowning at Tuon and Seleucia.
This name foolishness was their fault. Seleucia had told Aginan that her name was now Lylwyn Shipless, and that was the name Aginan was using. Well, he was not about to put up with that sort of thing, not for himself and not for her. She had to come to her senses, soon or late.
I'm just saying,
Noel said.
Come on, Ulver.
Matt slid off after them, but before he reached the door, Tuon spoke.
No warnings for us to remain inside, Toy? No one left to guard us?
The dice said he should find Harnin or one of the other Red Arms and plant him outside just to guard against accidents, but he did not hesitate.
You gave your word, he said, settling his hat on his head.
The smile he got in reply was worth the risk. Burn him, but it lit up her face. Women were always a gamble, but sometimes a smile could be win enough.
He saw from the entrance that Jurador's days without a Seanchan presence had come to an end. Directly across the road from the show, 700 men were taking off armor, unloading wagons, setting up tents in ordered rows, establishing horse lines. All very efficiently done. He saw Terrabanners with mail veils hanging from their helmets and bars of blue, yellow, and green painted across their breastplates, and men who were clearly infantry, stacking long pikes and racking bows, much shorter than a Two Rivers bow, in armor painted the same. He thought those must be Amadisians. Neither Terrabon nor Altara ran much to foot, and Altarans in service to the Seanchan had their armor marked differently for some reason. There were actual Seanchan, of course, perhaps 20 or 30 that he could see. There was no mistaking that painted armor of overlapping plates or those strange insectile helmets. Three of the soldiers came ambling across the road, lean, hard-bitten men. Their blue coats, with the collars striped green and yellow, were plain enough despite the colors, and showed the wear of armor use, but no signs of rank. Not officers, then, but still maybe as dangerous as Red Adders. Two of the fellows could have been from Andor or Murindi or even the Two Rivers, but the third had eyes tilted like a Saldaean's, and his skin was the color of honey. Without slowing, they started into the show. One of the horse handlers at the entrance gave a shrill, three-note whistle that began to echo through the show, while the other, a squint-eyed fellow named Bolin, pushed the glass pitcher in front of the three.
"Price is a silver penny each, Captain," he said with deceptive mildness.
Matt had heard the big man speak in the same tone, a heartbeat before he thumped another horse handler over the head with a stool.
"Children is 5 coppers if they's more than waist high on me, and 3 if they's shorter, but only children as has to be carried gets in free."
The honey-skinned Seanchan raised a hand as if to push Bolin out of his way, then hesitated, his face growing harder, if that was possible. The other two squared up beside him, fists clenched as pounding boots announced the arrival of every man in the show, it seemed, performers in their flashy garb and horse handlers in coarse wool. Every man had a club of some sort in his hand, including Luca in a brilliant red coat embroidered with gold stars to his turned-down boot tops, and even the bare-chested Petra, who possessed the mildest nature of any man Matt had ever met. Petra's face was a thunderhead now, though. Like this had the makings of a massacre with these fellows' companions not 100 paces away and all their weapons to hand. It was a good place for Matt Cawthon to take himself out of. Surreptitiously, he touched the throwing knives hidden up his sleeves and shrugged just to feel the one hanging down behind the back of his neck. No way to check those under his coat or in his boots without being noticed, though. The dice seemed like continuous thunder. He began to plan how to get Tuon and the others away. He had to hang on to her a while longer yet. Before disaster could open the door, another Seanchan appeared in blue, green, and yellow striped armor, but carrying her helmet on her right hip. She had the tilted eyes and honey-colored skin, and there was a scattering of white in her close-cropped black hair. She was near a foot shorter than any of the other three, and there were no plumes on her helmet, just a small crest like a bronze arrowhead at the front. But the three soldiers stood up very straight when they saw her. Now why am I not surprised to find you here at what looks to be the fine beginnings of a riot, Murel? Her slurred accent had a twang in it. What's this all about, then? We paid our money, standard-bearer, the honey-skinned man replied in the same twangy accents. Then they said we had to pay more on account of us being soldiers of the Empire. Bolin opened his mouth, but she silenced him with a raised hand. She had that kind of presence. Running her eyes over the men gathered in a thick semicircle with their clubs, and pausing a moment to shake her head over Luca, she settled on Matt. Did you see what happened?
I did, Matt replied. And they tried to walk in without paying.
That's good for you, Murel, she said, getting a surprised blink from the man. Good for all three of you. Means you won't be out your coin, because you're all confined to camp for 10 days, and I doubt this show will be here that long. You're all docked 10 days' pay as well. You're supposed to be unloading wagons so the home folks don't get the idea we think we're better than they are. Or do you want a charge of causing dissension in the ranks? The three men paled visibly. Apparently that was a serious charge.
I didn't think so. Now get out of my sight and get to work before I make it a full month instead of a week.
Yes, standard-bearer, they snapped out as one, then ran back across the road as hard as they could go while tugging off their coats. Hard men, yet the standard-bearer was harder. She was not finished, however. Luca stepped forward, bowing with a grand flourish, but she cut off whatever thanks he was about to offer.
I don't much like fellows threatening my men with cudgels, she drawled, resting her free hand on her sword hilt. Not even Murel. Not at these odds. Still, shows you have backbone. Any of you fine fellows want a life of glory and adventure? Step across the road with me and I'll sign you up. You there in that fancy red coat. You have the look of a born lancer to me. I'll wager I can whip you into a proper hero in no time.
A ripple of head-shaking ran through the assembled men, and some, seeing that no trouble was likely now, began slipping away. Petra was one of those. Luca looked as though he had been pole-axed. A number of others appeared almost as stunned by the offer. Performing paid better than soldiering, and you avoided the risk of people sticking swords into you.
Well, as long as you're standing here, maybe I can convince you. Not likely you'll get rich, but the pay is usually on time, and there's always the chance of loot if the order is given. Happens now and then. The food varies, but it's usually hot, and there's usually enough to fill your belly. The days are long, but that just means you're tired enough to get a good night's sleep. When you don't have to work the night, too. Anyone interested yet?
Luca gave himself a shake.
Thank you, Captain, but no, he said, sounding
half-strangled. Some fools thought soldiers were flattered by someone thinking they had a higher rank than they did. Some fool soldiers were.
Excuse me, if you please. We have a show to put on, and people who aren't going to be pleased if they have to wait much longer to see it.
With a last wary look at the woman, as if he feared she might try to drag him off by his collar, he rounded on the men behind him.
All of you! Get back to your stands. What are you doing lounging around here? I have everything well in hand. Get back to your stands before people start demanding their money back.
That would have been a disaster in his book. Given the choice between handing back coin and having a riot, Luca would have been unable to decide which was worse. With the show folk dispersing and Luca hurrying away while shooting glances at her over his shoulder, the woman turned to Matt, the only man remaining aside from those two horse handlers.
And what about you? From the look of you, you might be made an officer and get to give me orders.
She sounded amused by the notion. He knew what she was doing. The people in the line had seen 3 Shonchan soldiers sent running, and who could say for sure why they had run, but now they had seen her disperse a much larger crowd by herself. He would have given her a place in the band as a bannerman in a breath.
I'd make a terrible soldier, standard-bearer, he said, tipping his hat, and she laughed.
As he turned away, he heard Bolin saying mildly,
You didn't hear what I told that man? It's a silver penny for you and another for your good wife.
Coins clinked into the pitcher. Thank you. Things were back to normal, and the dice were still racketing in his head. Making his way through the show, where acrobats were again tumbling for the crowds on their wooden platforms, and jugglers juggling, and Clarine's dogs running atop large wooden balls, and Miora's leopards standing on their hind legs inside a cage that looked barely strong enough to hold them, he decided to check on the Aes Sedai. The leopards brought them to mind. The common soldiers might spend the day working, yet he would have laid coin on at least some of the officers coming for a look before long. He trusted Tuon, strangely enough, and Aginan had enough sense to stay out of sight when there might be other Seanchan around. But common sense seemed in short supply among Aes Sedai. Even Teslin and Edesina, who had spent time as Demani, took foolish chances. Jolene, who had not, seemed to think herself invulnerable. Everybody in the show knew the three women were Aes Sedai now, but their large wagon, covered with rain-streaked whitewash, still stood near the canvas-topped storage wagons not far from the horse lines. Luca had been willing to rearrange his show for a high lady who gave him a warrant of protection, but not for Aes Sedai, who put him at risk with their presence and were practically penniless besides. The women among the show folk were sympathetic to the sisters for the most part, the men wary to one degree or another. It was almost always so with Aes Sedai. But Luca likely would have turned them out to make their own way without Matt's gold. Aes Sedai were more threat than anything else, so long as they were in lands controlled by the Seanchan. Matt Cawthon got no thanks for it, not that he was looking for any. He would have settled for a touch of respect, unlikely as that was. Aes Sedai were Aes Sedai, after all. Jolene's warders, Blerick and Fenn, were nowhere to be seen, so there was no need to talk his way past them to get inside, but as he approached the dirt-streaked steps at the back of the wagon, the fox-head medallion hanging beneath his shirt went icy cold against his chest, then colder still. For a moment he froze like a statue. Those fool women were channeling in there. Coming to himself, he pounded up the steps and banged the door open. The women he expected to see were all present. Jolene, a green sister, slender and pretty and big-eyed, and Teslin, a narrow-shouldered red who looked as though she chewed rocks, and Edesina, a yellow, handsome, rather than pretty, with waves of black hair spilling to her waist. He had saved all three from the Seanchan, had gotten Teslin and Edesina out of the Demani kennels themselves, yet their gratitude was variable, to say the best. Bethamin, as dark as Tuon, but tall and nicely rounded, and yellow-haired Sita had been Suldam before they were forced into helping rescue the three Aes Sedai. The five of them shared this wagon, the Aes Sedai to keep an eye on the former Suldam to keep an eye on the Aes Sedai. None realized their task, but mutual distrust made them carry it out assiduously. The one woman he had not expected to see was Sitala Annan, who had kept the wandering woman in Ebu Dar before she decided to make herself part of that rescue for some reason. But then Sitala had a way of pushing herself in, of meddling, in fact. She meddled between him and Tuon incessantly. What they were doing was completely unexpected, though. In the middle of the wagon, Bethamin and Sita were standing rigid as fence posts, jammed shoulder to shoulder between the two beds that could not be raised against the walls, and Jolene was slapping Bethamin's face again and again, first with one hand, then the other. Silent tears trickled down the tall woman's cheeks, and Sita looked afraid that she would be next. Edesina and Teslin, arms folded beneath their breasts, were watching with no expression whatsoever, while Mistress Annan frowned her disapproval over Teslin's shoulder. Whether disapproval of the slapping or of what Bethamin had done to earn it, he could not have said and did not care. Crossing the floor in one stride, he seized Jolene's upraised arm and spun her around.
"What in the light are you—"
That was as far as he got before she used her other hand to catch him a buffet so hard that his ears rang.
"Now that killed the goat," he said,
and, spots still floating in his vision, he dropped down onto the nearest bed and pulled a surprised Jolene across his lap. His right hand landed on her bottom with a loud smack that pulled a startled squawk from her. The medallion went colder still, and Edesina gasped when nothing happened, but he tried to keep one eye on the other two sisters and one eye on the open door for Jolene's warders, while he held her in place and whacked as fast and as hard as he could. With no idea how many shifts or petticoats she was wearing under that worn blue wool, he wanted to make sure he left an impression. It seemed his hand was beating time for the dice spinning in his head. Struggling and kicking, Jolene began cursing like a wagon driver, as the medallion seemed to turn to ice, and then to grow so cold he wondered if it would give him frostbite. But he soon added wordless yelps to her pungent vocabulary. His arm might not match Petra's, but he was far from weak. Practice with bow and quarterstaff gave you strong arms. Edesina and Teslin seemed as frozen in place as the two wide-eyed former Suldam. Well, Bethamin was grinning, and she appeared as amazed as Sita. But just as he began to think Jolene's yelps were outnumbering her curses, Mistress Annan tried to push past the two Aes Sedai. Astonishingly, Teslin made a peremptory gesture for her to remain where she was. Very few women or men argued with an Aes Sedai's commands, but Mistress Annan gave the Red Sister a frosty look and squeezed between the two Aes Sedai, muttering something that made both of them eye her curiously. She still had to force her way between Bethamin and Sita, and he took advantage of that to land a final flurry of hard smacks, then rolled the Green Sister off his lap. His hand had begun to sting anyway. Jolene landed with a thump and let out a gasped, "Oh!" Planting herself in front of him, close enough that she interfered with Jolene's hasty scramble to her feet, Mistress Annan studied him with her arms folded beneath her breasts in a way that increased the generous cleavage displayed by her plunging neckline. Despite the dress, she was not Ebu Dare, not with those hazel eyes, but she had large golden hoops in her ears, a marriage knife, the hilt marked with red and white stones for her sons and daughters, dangling from a wide silver collar around her neck, and a curved dagger thrust behind her belt. Her dark green skirts were sewn up on the left side to show red petticoats. With touches of gray in her hair, she was every inch the stately Ebu Dare innkeeper, sure of herself and accustomed to giving orders. He expected her to upbraid him. She was as good as an Aes Sedai when it came to upbraiding. So he was surprised when she spoke, sounding very thoughtful.
"Jolene must have tried to stop you, and Teslin and Edesina as well. But whatever they did failed. I think that means you possess a Tirangreal that can disrupt flows of the power. I've heard of such things. Cadswain Maladrin supposedly had one, or so rumor said. But I've never seen the like. I would very much like to. I won't try to take it away from you, but I would appreciate seeing it."
"How do you know Cadswain?" Jolene demanded, attempting to brush off the seat of her skirt.
The first brush of her hand brought a wince, and she gave over with a glare for Matt just to show him she still had him in mind. Tears glistened in her big brown eyes and on her cheeks, but if he had to pay for them, it was worth the price.
"She said something about the test for the shawl," Edesina said.
"She did say, 'How could you have passed the test for the shawl if you freeze at moments like this?'" Teslin added.
Mistress Annan's mouth tightened for a moment, but if she was discomposed, she regained her poise in a breath.
"You may recall that I owned an inn," she said dryly. "Many people visited the Wandering Woman, and many of them talked, perhaps more than they should have."
"No Aes Sedai would,"
Jolene began, then turned hurriedly. Blerick and Fenn were starting up the steps. Borderlanders both, they were big men, and Matt quickly got to his feet, ready to use his knives if necessary. They might drub him, but not without bleeding for it. Surprisingly, Jolene darted to the door and shut it tight in Fenn's face, then fastened the latch. The Saldaean made no effort to open the door, but Matt had no doubt the pair of them would be waiting when he left. When she turned around, her eyes were blazing hot, tears and all, and she seemed to have forgotten Mistress Annan for the moment.
"If you ever even think of—"
she began, shaking a finger at him. He stepped forward and stuck a finger of his own to her nose so fast that she jumped back and bumped into the door, from which she rebounded with a squeak, spots of red blooming in her cheeks. He cared not a whisker whether that was anger or embarrassment. She opened her mouth, but he refused to let her get a word in edgewise.
"Except for me, you'd be wearing a demonic collar around your neck, and so would Edesina and Teslin," he said,
as much heat in his voice as there was in her eyes.
"In return, you all try to bully me. You go your own way and endanger all of us. You bloody well channeled when you know there are Shonchan right across the road. They could have a demoni with them, or a dozen for all you know."
He doubted there was even one, but doubt was not certainty, and in any case, he was not about to share his doubts with her, not now.
"Well, I might have to put up with some of that, though you'd better know I'm getting close to my edge.
but I won't put up with you hitting me. You do that again, and I vow I'll pepper your hide twice as hard and twice as hot. My word on it.
And I won't try to stop him next time if you do, Mistress Onan said.
Nor I, Teslin added, echoed after a long moment by Edesina.
Jolene looked as though she had been hit between the eyes with a hammer. Very satisfactory. As long as he could figure out how to avoid having his bones broken by Blerick and Fenn.
Now, would someone like to tell me why you bloody decided to start channeling like it was the last battle? Do you have to keep holding them like that, Edesina?
He nodded at Sita and Bethamin. It was only an educated guess, but Edesina's eyes widened for a moment as if she thought his Tirangrial let him see flows of the power as well as stop them. In any case, an instant later, both women were standing normally. Bethamin calmly began drying her tears with a white linen handkerchief. Sita sat down on the nearest bed, hugging herself and shivering. She looked more shaken than Bethamin. None of the Aes Sedai seemed to want to answer, so Mistress Annan did it for them.
There was an argument. Jolene wanted to go see these Shon Chan for herself, and she wouldn't be argued out of it. Bethamin decided to discipline her, just as if she had no clue what would happen.
The innkeeper shook her head in disgust.
She tried to pull Jolene across her lap, with Sita helping her, and Edesina wrapped them up in flows of air.
I'm assuming, she said, when the Aes Sedai all looked at her sharply.
I may not be able to channel, but I do use my eyes.
That doesn't account for what I felt, Matt said. There was a lot of channeling going on in here.
Mistress Annan and the three Aes Sedai studied him speculatively, long stares that seemed to probe for the medallion. They were not going to forget about his Tirangrial, that was for sure. Jolene took up the story.
Bethamin channeled. I've never before seen the weave she used, but for a few moments, until she lost the source, she had sparks dancing all over the three of us. I think she may have used as much of the power as she could draw.
Sobs suddenly racked Bethamin. She sagged halfway to falling to the floor.
I didn't mean to,
she wept, shoulders shaking, face contorted.
I thought you were going to kill me, but I didn't mean to. I didn't.
Sita began rocking back and forth, staring at her friend in horror. Or perhaps her former friend. They both knew Adam could hold them, and maybe any Suldam, but they might well have denied the full import. Any woman who could use an Adam could learn to channel. Likely they had tried as hard as they could to deny that hard fact, to forget it. Actually channeling altered everything, however. Burn him, this was all he needed on top of everything else.
What are you going to do about it? Only an Aes Sedai could handle this. Now she's started, she can't just stop, I know that much.
Let her die, Teslin said harshly. We can keep her shielded until we can be rid of her. Then she can die.
We can't do that, Edesina said, sounding almost shocked,
though not apparently at the thought of Bethamin dying.
Once we let her go, she'll be a danger to everyone around her. I won't do it again,
Bethamin wept, almost pleading.
I won't.
Pushing past Matt as if he were a coat rack, Jolene confronted Bethamin, staring up at the taller woman with her fists on her hips.
You won't stop. You can't, once you begin. Oh, you may be able to go months between attempts to channel, but you will try again and again, and every time your danger will increase.
With a sigh, she lowered her hands.
You are much too old for the novice book, but there's nothing for it. We will have to teach you. Enough to make you safe, at least.
Teach her,
Teslin screeched, planting her fists on her hips.
I do say let her die. Do you have any idea how these Suldam did treat me when they did have me prisoner?
No, since you've never gone into detail beyond moaning over how horrible it was, Jolene replied dryly, then added in very firm tones,
but I will not leave any woman to die when I can stop it.
That did not end things, of course. When a woman wanted to argue, she could keep it going if she was by herself, and they all wanted to argue. Edesina joined in on Jolene's side, and so did Mistress Annan, just as if she had as much right to speak as the Aes Sedai. Of all things, Bethamin and Sita took Teslin's part, denying any wish to learn to channel, waving their hands and arguing as loudly as anyone. Wisely, Matt took the opportunity to slip out of the wagon and pull the door shut behind him softly. No need to remind them of him. The Aes Sedai, at least, would remember soon enough. At least he could stop worrying about where the bloody Aedom were, and whether the Suldam would try using them again. That was well and truly finished now. He had been right about Bleric and Fenn. They were waiting at the foot of the steps, and storm clouds were not in it for their faces. Without any doubt, they knew exactly what had happened to Jolene. But not who was to blame, it turned out.
"What went on in there, Cawthon?"
Bleric demanded, his blue eyes sharp enough to poke holes. Slightly the taller of the two, he had shaved his Shinaran topknot and was not best pleased by the growth of short hair covering his scalp.
"Were you involved?" Fenn asked coldly.
"How could I have been?" Matt replied, trotting down the steps as if he had not a care in the world. "She's an Aes Sedai, in case you hadn't noticed. If you want to know what happened, I suggest you ask her.
I'm not wool-headed enough to talk about it, I'll tell you that.
Only I wouldn't ask her right now. They're all still arguing in there. I took the chance to slip out while my hide was still intact." Not the best choice of words, perhaps. The two warders' faces grew darker still, impossible as that seemed. But they let him go on his way without having to resort to his knives. There was that. Neither seemed very eager to enter the wagon, either. Instead, they settled on the wagon's steps to wait. More fools they. He doubted Jolene would be very forthcoming with them, but she might well take out some of her temper on them, because they knew. Had he been them, he would have found tasks to keep him clear of that wagon for, say a month or two. That might help. Some. Women had long memories for some things. He was going to need to watch over his shoulder for Jolene himself from now on. But it had still been worth it. With Shan Chan camped across the road, and Aes Sedai arguing, and women channeling as if they had never heard of the Shan Chan, and the dice spinning in his head, not even winning two games of stones from Tuan that night could make him feel anything but wary. He went to sleep, on the floor, since it was Doman's turn to use the second bed. Eginen always got the other. With the dice bouncing off the insides of his skull, but he was sure that tomorrow had to be better than today. Well, he had never claimed to always be right. He just wished he was not quite so wrong so often. Chapter 8 Dragon's Eggs. Luca had the showfolk breaking camp, taking down the big canvas wall and packing everything into the wagons while the sky was still dark the next morning. It was the clatter and banging of it, the shouting, that woke Matt, groggy and stiff from sleeping on the floor. As much as he could sleep, for the bloody dice. Those things gave a man dreams that slaughtered sleep. Luca was rushing about in his shirt sleeves with a lantern, giving orders and likely impeding matters as much as speeding them, but Petra, wide enough to seem squat, though he was not all that much shorter than Matt, paused in hitching the four-horse team to his and Clarine's wagon to explain. With the waning moon low on the horizon and half hidden by trees, a lantern on the driver's seat gave all the light they had, a flickering pool of yellow that was repeated 100 times and more through the camp. Clarine was off walking the dogs, since they would be spending most of the day inside the wagon.
"Yesterday,"
the strong man shook his head and patted the nearest animal, patiently waiting for the last straps to be buckled, as if the horse had showed signs of nerves. Maybe he felt edgy himself. The night was only cool, not really cold, yet he was bundled up in a dark coat and had on a knitted cap. His wife worried about him falling sick from drafts or the cold, and took care that he would not.
"Well, we're strangers everywhere, you see, and a lot of people think they can take advantage of strangers. But if we let one man get away with it, 10 more will try, if not 100. Sometimes the local magistrate or what passes for one will uphold the law for us too, but only sometimes. Because we're strangers, and tomorrow or the next day we'll be gone, and anyway everybody knows strangers are usually up to no good. So we have to stand up for ourselves, fight for what's ours, if need be. Once you do that, though, it's time to move along. Same now as when there were only a few dozen of us with Luca, counting the horse handlers, though in those days we'd have been gone as soon as those soldiers left. In those days there weren't so many coins to be lost by leaving in a hurry," he said dryly, and shook his head, perhaps for Luca's greed or perhaps for how large the show had grown, before going on. "Those 3 Shan Chan have friends, or at least companions who won't like their own being faced down. That standard-bearer did it, but you can be sure they'll lay it to us, because they think they can hit at us, and they can't at her. Maybe their officers will uphold the law, or their rules, or whatever, like she did, but we can't be sure of that. What is certain, though, is that those fellows will cause trouble if we stay another day. No point to staying when it means fights with soldiers, and maybe people hurt so they can't perform, and sure trouble with the law one way or another."
It was the longest speech Matt had ever heard from Petra, and the man cleared his throat as though embarrassed by saying so much.
"Well," he muttered, bending back to the harness, "Luca will want to be on the road soon. You want to be seeing to your own horses."
Matt wanted no such thing. The most wonderful thing about having coin was not what you could buy, but that you could pay others to do the work. As soon as he realized the show was preparing to move, he had rousted the four Red Arms from the tent they shared with Chell Vannon to hitch the teams for his wagon and Tuon's, do as he instructed with the razor, and saddle Pips. The stout horse thief—he had not stolen a horse since Matt had known him, but that was what he was—had roused himself long enough to say that he would get up when the others returned, then rolled over in his blankets and was snoring again before Harnan and the others had their boots half on. Vannon's skills were such that no one voiced any complaint beyond the usual grumbling about the hour, and all but Harnan would have grumbled if allowed to sleep till noon. When those skills were needed, he would repay them tenfold, and they knew it, even Fergin. The skinny Red Arm was none too bright except when it came to soldiering, but he was plenty smart enough there. Well, smart enough. The show left Jurador before the sun broke the horizon. A long snake of wagons rolling along the wide road through the darkness with Luca's lurid monstrosity pulled by six horses at its head. Tuon's wagon came just behind, with Gordaren driving, almost wide-shouldered enough to seem a strong man himself, and Tuon and Seleucia, well cloaked and hooded, squeezed in on either side of him. The storage wagons and animal cages and spare horses brought up the tail. Sentries at the Seanchan camp watched them depart, silent armored figures in the night marching the camp's perimeter. Not that the camp itself was quiet. Shadowy forms stood in rigid lines among the tents while loud voices bellowed the roll call at a steady pace and others answered. Matt all but held his breath until those regular shouts faded away behind him. Discipline was a wonderful thing. For other men, anyway. He rode Pips alongside the Aes Sedai wagon near the middle of the long line, flinching a little every time the foxhead went cool against his chest, which it began to do before they had gone much more than a mile. It seemed that Jolene was wasting no time. Fergin, handling the reins, chattered away about horses and women with Metwin. Both were as happy as pigs in clover, but then neither had any idea what was going on inside the wagon. At least the medallion only turned cool, and barely that. They were using small amounts of the power. Still, he disliked being so near any channeling at all. In his experience, Aes Sedai carried trouble in their belt pouches and seldom were shy about scattering it, never mind who might be in the way. No, with the dice bouncing inside his head, he could have done without Aes Sedai within 10 miles. He would have ridden up beside Tuon for the chance to talk with her, no matter that Seleucia and Gordaren would hear every word, but you never wanted a woman thinking you were too eager. Do that, and she either took advantage or else skittered away like a water drop on a hot greased griddle. Tuon found enough ways to take advantage already, and he had too little time for very much in the way of chasing. Sooner or later she would speak the words that completed the marriage ceremony, sure as water was wet. But that only made it more urgent for him to find out what she was like, which had hardly been easy so far. That little woman made a blacksmith's puzzle seem simple. But how could a man be married to a woman if he did not know her? Worse, he had to make her see him as something more than toy. Marriage to a woman with no respect for him would be like wearing a shirt of black wasp nettles day and night. Worse still, he had to make her care for him, or he would find himself forced to hide from his own wife to keep her from making him Dacovale. And to cap it off, he had to do all of that in whatever time remained before he had to send her back to Abu Dhar. A fine stew, and doubtless a tasty meal for some hero out of legend, a little something to occupy his idle time before he rushed off to perform some great deed. Only Matt Bloody Cawthon was no bloody hero. He still had it to do, though, and no time or room for missteps. It was the earliest start they had made yet, but his hopes that the Shonchan had frightened Luca into moving faster were soon dashed. As the sun climbed, they passed stone farm buildings clinging to hillsides and occasionally a tiny tile or thatch-roofed village, nestled beside the road in a surround of stone-walled fields carved out of the forest, where men and women stood gaping as the show streamed past and children ran alongside until their parents called them back. But in the mid-afternoon, the show reached something larger. Runyon Crossing, near a so-called river that could have been waded in fewer than 20 paces without going more than waist-deep despite the stone bridge across it, was never a patch on Jurador, but it possessed 4 inns, each 3 stories of stone roofed in green or blue tiles, and near 1/2 mile of hard-packed dirt between the village and the river where merchants could park their wagons for the night. Farms with their walled fields and orchards and pastures made a quilt of the countryside for a good league along the road and maybe more beyond the hills to either side of it. They certainly covered the hillsides Matt could see. That was enough for Luca. Ordering the canvas wall erected in the clearing, near to the river to make watering the animals easier, the man strutted into the village wearing coat and cloak red enough to make Matt's eyes hurt, and so embroidered with golden stars and comets that a tinker would have wept for the shame of donning the garments. The huge blue and red banner was stretched across the entrance, each wagon in its place. The performing platforms unloaded and the wall nearly all up by the time he returned, escorting 3 men and 3 women. The village was not all that far from Ebudar, yet their clothing might have come from another country altogether. The men wore short wool coats and bright colors embroidered with angular scrollwork along the shoulders and sleeves, and dark baggy trousers stuffed into knee boots. The women, their hair in a sort of coiled bun atop their heads, wore dresses nearly as colorful as Luca's garments, their narrow skirts resplendent with flowers from hem to hips. They did all carry long belt knives, though with straight blades for the most part, and caressed the hilts whenever anybody looked at them. That much was the same. Altara was Altara when it came to touchiness. These were the village mayor, the 4 innkeepers, and a lean, leathery, white-haired woman in red. The others addressed her respectfully as mother. Since the round-bellied mayor was as white-haired as she, not to mention mostly bald, and none of the innkeepers lacked at least a little gray hair, Matt decided she must be the village wisdom. He smiled and tipped his hat to her as she passed, and she gave him a sharp look and sniffed in near-perfect imitation of Nynaeve. Oh, yes, a wisdom, all right. Luca showed them around with wide smiles and expansive gestures, elaborate bows and flourishes of his cloak, stopping here and there to make a juggler or a team of acrobats perform a little for his guests, but his smile turned to a sour grimace once they were safely back on their way and out of sight.
"Free admission for them and their husbands and wives and all the children," he growled to Matt. "And I'm supposed to pack up if a merchant comes down the road." They weren't that blunt, but they were clear enough, especially that Mother Darvale, as if this fly speck ever attracted enough merchants to fill this field.
"Thieves and scoundrels, Cotton. Country folk are all thieves and scoundrels, and an honest man like me is at their mercy."
Soon enough, he was totting up what he might earn there despite the complimentary admissions. But he never did give over complaining entirely, even when the line at the entrance stretched nearly as far as it had in Jurador. He just added complaining about how much he would have taken in with another 3 or 4 days at the Salt Town. It was 3 or 4 days now, and likely he would have lingered until the crowds had dwindled to nothing. Maybe those 3 Shonchen had been Taviran work. Not likely, but it was a pleasant way to think of it. Now that it was all in the past, it was. That was how they progressed, at best a mere 2 leagues or perhaps 3, at an unhurried pace, and usually Luca would find a small town or a cluster of villages that he felt called for a halt. Or better to say that he felt their silver calling to him. Even if they passed nothing but fly specks not worth the labor of erecting the wall, they never made as much as 4 leagues before Luca called a halt. He was not about to risk having to camp strung out along the road. If there was not to be a show, Luca liked to find a clearing where the wagons could be parked without too much crowding, though if driven to it, he would dicker with a farmer for the right to stop in an unused pasture, and mutter over the expense the whole next day if it cost no more than a silver penny. He was tight with his purse strings, Luca was. Trains of merchants' wagons pass them in both directions, making good speed and managing to raise small clouds of dust from the hard-packed road. Merchants wanted to get their goods to market as quickly as possible. Now and then they saw a caravan of tinkers, too, their boxy wagons as bright as anything in the show except for Luca's wagon. All of them were headed toward Ebu Dar, oddly enough, but then they moved as slowly as Luca. Not likely any coming the other way would overtake the show. 2 or 3 leagues a day, and the dice rattled away so that Matt was always wondering what lay beyond the next bend in the road, or what was catching him up from behind. It was enough to give a man hives. The very first night, outside Runyon Crossing, he approached Aludra. Near her bright blue wagon, she had set up a small canvas enclosure 8 feet tall for launching her night flowers, and she straightened with a glare when he pulled back a flap and ducked in. A closed lantern sitting on the ground near the wall gave enough light for him to see that she was holding a dark ball the size of a large melon. Runyon Crossing was only big enough to merit a single night flower. She opened her mouth, all set to chivy him out. Not even Luca was allowed in here. "Lofting tubes," he said quickly, gesturing to the metal-bound wooden tube, as tall as he was and near enough a foot across, sitting upright in front of her on a broad wooden base. "That's why you want a bell-founder, to make lofting tubes from bronze. It's the why I can't puzzle out." It seemed a ridiculous idea. With a little effort, 2 men could lift one of her lofting tubes into the wagon that carried them and her other supplies. A bronze lofting tube would require a derrick. But it was the only thing that had occurred to him. With the lantern behind her, shadows hid her expression, but she was silent for a long moment. "Such a clever young man," she said finally. Her beaded braids clicked softly as she shook her head. Her laugh was low and throaty.
"Me? I should watch my tongue. I always get into the trouble when I make promises to clever young men. Never think I will tell you the secrets that would make you blush, though, not now. You are already juggling 2 women, it seems, and me, I will not be juggled."
"Then I'm right?" He was barely able to keep the incredulity from his voice.
"You are," she said,
and casually tossed the night flower at him. He caught it with a startled oath and only dared to breathe when he was sure he had a good grip. The covering seemed to be stiff leather, with a tiny stub of fuse sticking out of one side. He had a little familiarity with smaller fireworks, and supposedly those only exploded from fire, or if you let air touch what was inside. Though he had cut one open once without it going off, yet who could say what might make a night flower erupt? The firework he had opened had been small enough to hold in one hand. Something the size of this night flower would likely blow him and Aludra to scraps. Abruptly, he felt foolish. She was not very likely to go throwing the thing if dropping it was dangerous. He began tossing the ball from hand to hand. Not to make up for gasping and all that, just for something to do. How will casting lofting tubes from bronze make them a better weapon? That was what she wanted, weapons to use against the Seanchan to repay them for destroying the Guild of Illuminators. They seem fearsome enough to me already. Aludra snatched the night flower back, muttering about clumsy oafs and turning the ball over in her hands to examine the leather surface. Maybe it was not so safe as he had assumed.
"A proper lofting tube," she said, once she was sure he had not damaged the thing. "It will send this close to 300 paces straight up into the sky with the right charge, and a longer distance across the ground if the tube is tilted at an angle. But not far enough for what I have in mind. A lofting charge big enough to send it further would burst the tube. With a bronze tube, I could use a charge that would send something a little smaller close to 2 miles, making the slow match slower. To let it travel that far is easy enough. Smaller, but heavier, made of iron. And there would be nothing for pretty colors, only the bursting charge."
Matt whistled through his teeth, seeing it in his head, explosions erupting among the enemy before they were near enough to see you clearly. A nasty thing to be receiving. Now that would be as good as having Aes Sedai on your side, or some of those Ashaman. Better. Aes Sedai had to be in danger to use the power as a weapon, and while he had heard rumors about hundreds of Ashaman, rumors grew with every telling. Besides, if Ashaman were anything like Aes Sedai, they would start deciding where they were needed,
and then take over the whole fight. He began envisioning how to use Aludra's bronze tubes, and right away he spotted a glaring problem. All your advantage was gone if the enemy came from the wrong direction or got behind you, and if you needed derricks to move these things. These bronze lofting tubes...
Dragons, she broke in. Lofting tubes are for making the night flowers bloom, for delighting the eye. I will call them dragons, and the Shan Chan will howl when my dragons bite.
Her tone was grim as sharp stone.
These dragons, then, whatever you call them, they'll be heavy and hard to move. Can you mount them on wheels, like a wagon or cart? Would they be too heavy for horses to pull? She laughed again.
It's good to see you are more than the pretty face.
Climbing a 3-step folding ladder that put her waist nearly level with the top of the lofting tube, she set the nightflower into the tube with the fuse down. It slid in a little way and stopped, a dome above the top of the tube.
Hand me that, she told him, gesturing to a pole as long and thick as a quarterstaff.
When he handed it up to her, she held it upright and used a leather cap on one end to push the nightflower deeper. That appeared to take little effort.
I have already drawn plans for the dragon carts. 4 horses could draw one easily, along with a 2nd cart to hold the eggs. Not nightflowers, dragon's eggs. You see, I have thought long and hard about how to use my dragons, not just how to make them.
Pulling the capped rod from the tube, she climbed down and picked up the lantern.
Come, I must make the sky bloom a little. Then I want my supper and my bed.
Just outside the canvas enclosure stood a wooden rack filled with more peculiar implements, a forked stick, tongs as long as Matt was tall, other things just as odd and all made of wood. Setting the lantern on the ground, she placed the capped pole in the rack and took a square wooden box from a shelf.
I suppose now you want to learn how to make the secret powders, yes? Well, I did promise.
I am the guild now, she added bitterly, removing the box's lid. It was an odd box, a solid piece of wood drilled with holes, each of which held a thin stick. She plucked out one and replaced the lid.
I can decide what is secret.
Better than that, I want you to come with me. I know somebody will be happy to pay for making as many of your dragons as you want. He can make every Belfounder from Andor to Tyr stop casting bells and start casting dragons.
Avoiding Rand's name did not stop the colors from whirling inside his head and resolving for an instant into Rand, fully clothed, thank the light, talking with Loyal by lamplight in a wood-paneled room. There were other people, but the image focused on Rand and had vanished too quickly for Matt to make out who they were. He was pretty sure that what he saw was what was actually happening right that moment, impossible as that seemed. It would be good to see Loyal again, but burn him, there had to be some way to keep those things out of his head. And if he isn't interested... Again the colors came, but he resisted and they melted away. I can pay to have hundreds cast myself. A lot of them, anyway. The band was going to end up fighting Shan Chan and most likely Trollocs as well. And he would be there when it happened. There was no getting around the fact. Try to avoid it how he would, that bloody Taviran twisting would put him right in the bloody middle. So he was ready to pour out gold like water if it gave him a way to kill his enemies before they got close enough to poke holes in his hide. Aludra tilted her head to one side, pursing her rosebud lips.
Who is this man with such power?
It'll have to be a secret between us. Tom and Julin know, and Aginan and Doman and the Aes Sedai, Teslin and Jolene at least, and Vannon and the Red Arms, but nobody else. And I want to keep it that way. Blood and bloody ashes, far too many people knew already. He waited for her curt nod before saying, The Dragon Reborn. The colors swirled, and despite his fighting them again, became Rand and Loyal for a moment. This was not going to be as easy as it had seemed.
You know the Dragon Reborn, she said doubtfully.
We grew up in the same village, he growled, already fighting the colors. This time they nearly coalesced before vanishing. If you don't believe me, ask Teslin and Jolene. Ask Tom. But don't do it around anyone else. A secret, remember?
The guild has been my life since I was a girl.
She scraped one of the sticks quickly down the side of the box, and the thing sputtered into flame. It smelled of sulfur.
The dragons,
They are my life now. The dragons and revenge on the Shonchan. Bending, she touched the flame to a dark length of fuse that ran under the canvas. As soon as the fuse caught, she shook the stick until the fire went out, then dropped it. With a crackling hiss, the flame sped along the fuse.
I think me, I believe you.
She held out her free hand.
When you leave, I will go with you, and you will help me make my dragons.
For a moment, as he shook her hand, he was sure the dice had stopped, but a heartbeat later they were rattling again. It must have been imagination. After all, this agreement with Aludra might help the band, and incidentally Matt Cawthon stay alive, yet it could hardly be called fateful. He would still have to fight those battles, and however you planned, however well-trained your men were, luck played its part too, bad as well as good even for him. These dragons would not change that. But were the dice bouncing as loudly? He thought not. Yet how could he be sure? Never before had they slowed without stopping. It had to be his imagination. A hollow thump came from inside the enclosure, and acrid smoke billowed over the canvas wall. Moments later, the nightflower bloomed in the darkness above Runian Crossing, a great ball of red and green streaks. It bloomed again and again in his dreams that night, and for many nights after. But there it bloomed among charging horsemen and massed pikes, rending flesh as he had once seen stone rent by fireworks. In his dreams, he tried to catch the things with his hands, tried to stop them, yet they rained down in unending streams on 100 battlefields. In his dreams, he wept for the death and destruction. And somehow it seemed that the rattling of the dice in his head sounded like laughter. Not his laughter, the Dark One's laughter. The next morning, with the sun gesturing toward a cloudless sky, he was sitting on the steps of his green wagon, carefully scraping at the bowstave with a sharp knife. You had to be careful, almost delicate. A careless slice could ruin all your work. When Aginan and Doman came out. Strangely, they seemed to have dressed with special care, in their best, such as it was. He was not the only one to have bought cloth and Jurador, but without promises of Matt's gold to speed them, the seamstresses were still sewing for Doman and Aginan. The blue-eyed Shonchan woman wore a bright green dress, heavily embroidered, with tiny white and yellow flowers on the high neck and all down the sleeves. A flowered scarf held her long black wig in place. Doman, looking decidedly odd, with a head of very short hair and that Ilioner beard that left his upper lip bare, had brushed his worn brown coat till it actually had some semblance of neatness. They squeezed past Matt and hurried off without a word, and he thought no more of it until they returned an hour or so later to announce that they had been into the village and gotten Mother Darvale to marry them. He could not stop himself from gaping. Aginan's stern face and sharp eyes gave good indications of her character. What could have brought Doman to marry the woman? As soon marry a bear. Realizing the Ilioner was beginning to glare at him, he hastily got to his feet and made a presentable bow over the bowstave. Congratulations, Master Doman. Congratulations, Mistress Doman. The light shine on you both. What else was he to say? Doman kept glaring at him as if he had heard Matt's thoughts, though, and Aginan snorted.
My name is Lyalwyn Shipless, Cawthon, she drawled. That's the name I was given, and the name I'll die with. And a good name it is, since it helped me reach a decision I should have made weeks ago.
Frowning, she looked sideways at Doman.
You do understand why I could not take your name, don't you, Bale?
No, lass. Doman replied gently, resting a thick hand on her shoulder. But I will take you with any name you do care to use, so long as you do be my wife. I told you that.
She smiled and laid her hand atop his, and he began smiling too. Light, but the pair of them were sickening. If marriage made a man start smiling like dreamy syrup. Well, not Matt Cawthon. He might be as good as wed, but Matt Cawthon was never going to start carrying on like a loon.
And that was how he ended up in a green-striped wall tent, not very large, that belonged to a pair of lean Domani brothers who ate fire and swallowed swords. Even Tom admitted that Ballet and Abar were good,
and they were popular with the other performers, so finding them places to stay was easy, but that tent cost as much as the wagon had. Everybody knew he had gold to fling about, and that pair just sighed over giving up their snug home when he tried to bargain them down. Well, a new bride and groom needed privacy, and he was more than glad to give it to them, if it meant he did not have to watch them go moon-eyed at each other. Besides, he was tired of taking his turn sleeping on the floor. In the tent, at least, he had his own cot every night. Narrow and hard it might be, yet it was softer than floorboards. And with only him, he had more room than in the wagon, even after the rest of his clothes were moved in, and stowed in a pair of brass-bound chests. He had a washstand of his very own, a ladder-backed chair that was not too unsteady, a sturdy stool, and a table big enough to hold a plate and cup and a pair of decent brass lamps. The chest of gold he left in the green wagon. Only a blind fool would try robbing Doman. Only a madman would try robbing Eginen. Lyowin, if she insisted, though he was still certain she would regain her senses eventually. After the first night, spent close by the Aes Sedai wagon with the fox head cool for half the night, he had the tent set up facing Tuon's wagon by dint of making sure that the Red Arms started raising it before anyone else could claim the space.
"Are you placing yourself as my guard now?"
Tuon said coolly when she saw the tent for the first time.
"No," he replied. "I'm just hoping for more glimpses of you." That was the light's own truth.
Well, getting away from the Aes Sedai was part of it, but the other was true, too. Yet the woman waggled her fingers at Seleucia, and the pair of them launched into gales of giggles before recovering themselves and re-entering the faded purple wagon with all the dignity of a royal procession. Women! He was not often alone in the tent. He had taken on Lopin as his body servant after Nalisian's death, and the stout tyrant with his blocky face and a beard that nearly reached his chest was always popping in to bow his balding head and ask what Milord would enjoy for his next meal, or inquire whether Milord had any need of wine or tea, or would care for a plate of candied dried figs he had vaguely acquired somewhere. Lopin was vain over his ability to find delicacies where it seemed there could be none. That, or he was rifling through the clothes chests to see whether anything needed repair or cleaning or ironing. Something always did, in his estimation, though it all looked fine to Matt. Nerim, Talmanis's melancholy body servant, frequently accompanied him, largely because the skinny gray-haired Kyrianen was bored. Matt could not understand how anyone could get bored with not having any work to do, but Nerim was full of dolorous comments on how poorly Talmanis must be faring without him, mournfully sighing about five times a day that Talmanis must have given his place to another by now, and he was ready to wrestle Lopin, if need be, for a share of the cleaning and mending. He even wanted his turn blacking Matt's boots. Noel dropped by to spin his tall tails and Olver to play stones or snakes and foxes when he was not playing with Tuon instead. Tom came to play stones, too, and to share rumors he picked up in the towns and villages, knuckling his long white mustaches over the choicer bits. Julin brought his own reports, but he always brought Amathera as well. The former Panarch of Terabon was pretty enough for Matt to understand why the thief-catcher was interested, with a rosebud mouth just made for kissing, and she clung to Julin's arm as if she might return some of his feelings, but her big eyes always gazed fearfully toward Tuon's wagon, even when they were all inside Matt's tent. And it was still all Julin could do to keep her from dropping to her knees and putting her face to the ground whenever she glimpsed Tuon or Seleucia. She did the same with Eginen, and with Bethamin and Sita besides. Considering that Amathera had been Dacovale for just a matter of months, it fair made Matt's skin crawl. Tuon could not really mean to make him Dacovale when she was going to marry him, could she? He soon told them to stop bringing him rumors about Rand. Fighting the colors in his head was too much effort, and he lost that fight as often as he won. Sometimes it was all right, but sometimes he caught glimpses of Rand and Min, and it seemed those two were carrying on something awful. Anyway, the rumors were all the same, really. The dragon reborn was dead, killed by Aes Sedai, by Ashaman, by the Seanchan, by a dozen other assassins. No, he was in hiding. He was massing a secret army. He was doing some fool thing or other that varied village by village and usually inn by inn. The one thing that was clear was that Rand was no longer in Kyrian, and nobody had any idea where he was. The dragon reborn had vanished.
It was odd how many of these Altaran farmers and villagers and townsfolk seemed worried by that, as worried as the merchants passing through and the men and women who worked for them. Not one of those people knew any more of the Dragon Reborn than the tales they carried, yet his disappearance frightened them. Tom and Julin were clear on that until he made them stop. If the Dragon Reborn was dead, what was the world to do? That was the question that people asked over breakfast in the morning and ale in the evening and likely on going to bed. Matt could have told them Rand was alive. Those bloody visions made him sure of that. But explaining how he knew was another matter. Even Tom and Julin seemed uncertain about the colors. The merchants and the others would have thought him a madman, and if they believed, that would only scatter rumors about him, not to mention likely setting the Seanchan to hunting for him. All he wanted was the bloody colors out of his head. Moving into the tent made the show folk eye him very oddly, and small wonder. First, he had been running off with Aginan, Lyowin, if she insisted on it, and Doman supposedly was her servant. But now she was married to Doman, and Matt was out of the wagon entirely. Some of the show folk seemed to think it no more than he deserved for trailing after Tuon, yet a surprising number offered him sympathy. Several men commiserated over the fickleness of women, at least they did when there were no women around, and some of the unmarried women, contortionists and acrobats and seamstresses, began eyeing him much too warmly. He might have enjoyed that if they had not been so willing to give him smoky looks right in front of Tuon. The first time that happened, he was so startled that his eyes nearly popped. Tuon seemed to find it amusing, of all things. She seemed to. But only a fool thought he knew what was in a woman's head just because she had a smile on her face. He continued to dine with her every midday, if they were halted, and began arriving for his nightly games of stones early, so she had to feed him then, too. Light's truth, if you got a woman to feed you on a regular basis, she was halfway won. At least he dined with her when she would let him into the wagon. One night he found the latch down, and no amount of talking would make her or Seleucia open the door. It seemed a bird had managed to get inside during the day, an extremely bad omen, apparently, and the pair of them had to spend the night in prayer and contemplation to avert some evil or other. They seemed to run half their lives according to strange superstitions. Tuon or Seleucia, either one, would make odd signs with their hands if they saw a torn spider web with the spider in it. And Tuon explained to him, just as serious as if she were making sense, that the sure result of clearing away a spiderweb before shooing the spider out of it was the death of someone close to you within the month. They would see a flight of birds circle more than once and predict a storm, or draw a finger through a line of marching ants, count how long it took for the ants to rejoin their line, and predict how many days of fair weather lay ahead, and never mind that it did not work out that way. Oh, there was rain 3 days after the birds, crows, disturbingly enough, but it was nowhere near a storm, just a gray, drizzling day.
"Obviously Seleucia miscounted with the ants," Tuon said, placing a white stone on the board with that oddly graceful arching of her fingers. Seleucia, watching over her shoulder in a white blouse and divided brown skirts, nodded. As usual, she wore a headscarf over her short golden hair, even indoors, a length of red and gold silk that day. Tuon was all in brocaded blue silk, a coat of odd cut that covered her hips, and divided skirts so narrow they seemed to be wide trousers. She spent considerable time giving the seamstresses detailed instructions on what she wanted sewn, and little of it was much like anything he had ever seen before. It was all in Seanchan styles, he suspected, though she had had a few riding dresses sewn that would not draw comment for when she went outside. Rain pattered softly on the roof of the wagon. "Obviously, what the birds told us was modified by the ants. It is never simple, Toy. You must learn these things. I will not have you ignorant."
Matt nodded as if that made sense and placed his black stone. And she called his uneasiness about crows and ravens superstition. Knowing when to keep your mouth shut was a useful skill around women. Around men, too, but more so around women. You could be pretty certain what would set a man's eyes on fire. Talking with her could be dangerous in other ways, too.
"What do you know of the Dragon Reborn?" she asked him another evening.
He choked on a mouthful of wine, and the whirling colors in his brain dissipated in a fit of coughing. The wine was near enough vinegar, but even Nerim had a hard time finding good wine these days,
Well, he's the Dragon Reborn, he said, when he could speak, wiping wine from his chin with one hand. For a moment he saw Rand eating at a large dark table. What else is there to know? Seleucia refilled his cup smoothly.
A great deal, Tol-Tol-Tol-Toy. For
He must kneel to the crystal